This is the Porno Cultures Podcast, the show where we think about pornography rather than just react to it. Hello, my name is Brandon Arroyo, and welcome to the Porno Cultures Podcast. We all have websites that we have a habit of checking every day, and if we somehow wind up not checking them, it feels as if we've missed an essential part of our routine. My daily surfing habits include the typical Gmail, Facebook, Twitter, and of course the failing New York Times. And the one porn website that I check every day, without fail, is the gay porn news and gossip site Straight Up Gay Porn. Without a doubt, Straight Up Gay Porn is the most important blog about what's going on in the world of gay porn. It's the page six of gay porn, essentially. Showing up as part of its main headlines can either make your name in the business or ruin your reputation forever. Sure, while someone's attractiveness is mostly enough to overcome any bad story you've read about them on Straight Up Gay Porn, there's always that blog post in the back of your mind reminding you of just how terrible they are off camera. This blog is so influential in this way, it should come with a warning stating that this blog might have hazardous effects on your orgasm. The man behind the blog is Zachary Shire. He got his start in gay porn blogging in 2010 when he was tapped to be the editor of The Sword, which is also a porn distribution and production company. And in 2013, he broke away from The Sword and started Straight Up Gay Porn. The key to Shire's success is not just the stories that he's able to find, but that he's able to interject his own personality and wit into everything that he posts. He's not shy about calling out the worst elements of the porn industry, and his talent as a writer makes those takedowns hilarious to read. Hey, I mean, it says something about his talents that he's become the most famous person in gay porn who has never had to take off their clothing in front of a camera. While Zach lives and works out of Southern California, I was lucky enough to catch up with him while he was in New York City for the inaugural Straight Up Gay Porn Awards, which took place in June of 2017 during Gay Pride Weekend. They gave away awards for things like Best Ass, Best Orgy Scene, and of course Studio of the Year. I was lucky enough to attend the show, which featured all of the top gay porn stars in one room. You can imagine how fast my head was spinning being able to see all of my favorite porn performers in real life. Just in case you were wondering, one, yes, they all are as good looking in person as they are on camera. Two, they are all far shorter than they look on camera. And three, being able to talk with a lot of them during the after party proved that all of them are really nice guys who are pretty down to earth and have nothing but respect and love for their fans, which was really cool to experience firsthand. In this interview, Zach talks about how he got into the porn blogging business, explains how the award show came together, how politics and porn are eternally linked, the relationship between porn and gay pride, and he explains why he thinks dog pics are the new cock pics. So, without any delay, let's get into it. Here's my interview with the editor of Straight Up Gay Porn, Zachary Shire. Good morning, Zach.
Good morning, Brandon.
It's very early here in the morning, but Zach has to go to a very exclusive thing later on today, which I'm extremely jealous of. Thank you for making a little bit of time for us.
Absolutely.
So I'd like to start off by asking our guests, what was your first experience with pornography? What were the circumstances? What lingering feelings did it have with you? And what did you ultimately kind of learn from your first experience?
My first experience was probably when I was very young.
Barely legal.
Yeah, you could call it that. Yeah, I was a little kid and I found a magazine back in the 80s.
How little are we talking?
Oh, I was probably 9, 10. So there was a magazine, I think. I can't remember what the title of the magazine was, but it was your typical porn magazine. I lived in an apartment complex and I think it had been left by some of the gardening crew in their gardening shack. And
how you generous know, of them.
Yeah, and so I saw it and of course brought it home, and at this age and at this point in my life, I wasn't masturbating. It wasn't, at that point, it wasn't really a sexual thing. I was only 9, I think, so maybe even 8. Yeah, that was that, and I just sort of had it and I looked at it being fascinated by it. It was probably straight, and then my mom actually found it at some point days later, weeks later, and I felt this extreme amount of guilt And I got in a little bit of trouble. She sort of yelled at me and asked what I was doing with it. And I can't remember if I had actually been in trouble for it, but I remember it wasn't good. And I felt guilty and ashamed. And I remember tearing the magazine up and feeling really just like embarrassed. And I remember tearing it up and sort of throwing it away. And
so your first lesson was shame.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
And what about your first experience watching gay pornography?
It's a good question. And I can't remember off the top of my head. I'm sure it had to have been a magazine. Again, another magazine. This is going back to the 90s probably at this point. So I'm sure it was a magazine, and you know what it probably was? I guess you wouldn't consider this gay pornography at the time. It was probably a Playgirl magazine. Mm. Well, back then, it wasn't really considered gay pornography. It was all for women and
tons of women picking up that magazine.
And there was obviously no gay pictorials inside of it or anything. So that was my first, that was the gateway porn, right? Mm. So that led me to probably more magazines. And then I remember the first actual movie I saw was probably, there was a bookstore. But it was,
is that?
DVD bookstore. So they had DVDs and actually not even DVDs, I'm sorry, VHS tapes that you could rent. And it was interesting because I grew up in Orange County, California, which is very conservative. They had gay porn VHS and I rented pretty regularly, drove all the way down. It's about 20 minutes from my house. Yeah. I can't remember what the title was.
But it's always the most conservative districts that have the most porn consumption and fisting and all that, all the extreme stuff.
The most, yeah.
That's where the good stuff is.
Yeah.
Now, what about your career or passion for writing? When did you learn that did you always write when you were young, or is it something that you found out later when you went to school?
I was writing when I was in elementary school, junior high. It was always something I enjoy.
Did you have like your teenage sci-fi novel that you have stuffed in the closet somewhere? I've spoken to a lot of writers that like they wrote novels and they were like teenagers.
No, but it's funny. My obsession more was soap opera, melodrama, just sort of like multi-character, that kind of stuff. So more realistic.
Like actually
fiction.
Writing scripts?
Kind of. I mean, I didn't know how to write scripts back then. It was more of just sort of like these little short stories. And so it was just different stories, different characters going through different emotional arcs. Pretty bad stuff, I think. But that was junior high. A lot of it sort of evolved, hopefully, a little bit through high school into more sort of fiction.
So you always wanted to be a writer in some capacity?
Yeah, I mean, I always did write. I didn't know that I wanted to be one until probably after high school. But I didn't really start writing professionally until I was 30. Yeah, I didn't go to college till 27. And then when I got out, that was when I actually started actually writing.
And I'm sure the number one question you get asked is, how do you become a porn blogger? I know you started out working for gay magazines. Could you tell us a bit more about your rise through the ranks as a writer and reporter within the industry?
Yeah, it started at The Advocate and Out. This was back in 2008. And so Advocate and Out also owned sort of a trio of those magazines. They're all closed now, but it was Men, Unzipped, Freshmen. And they brought me on.
And those
were
magazines that were more sexually oriented.
Oh, yes. They showed everything. And I had a friend who worked in the legal department of that magazines. And he knew that they needed someone as an associate editor for the magazines and also to help build their blog traffic. And so, yeah, I started just doing mostly print and writing features on the models, interviews with the models, reviews of the movies, very black and white, just sort of standard traditional magazine writing. But then they realized that the blog was making them more money, obviously. And they wanted to build the blog traffic up. So they eventually sort of had me doing both. So I was writing whatever little amount of print articles they needed, and then mainly building the blog. And the blog was, I think, Unzipped Blog is what it was called.
Those were in the days where everyone had a blog. Now we're in the days where everyone has a podcast.
Oh, exactly. Hence, here we are.
And did you kind of immerse yourself in kind of like the history of porn and sexuality writing, like looking at old Screw magazines or old Playboys, which was kind of like doing innovative stuff really in the early days?
No. I tackled the topics or the subjects or whatever the stories were from what I learned to do in school and through my own background. And I graduated with a journalism degree, and technically it was called literary journalism, which is or creative nonfiction. But yeah, it's a journalism degree from UC Irvine. So I approached it just from a nonfiction, sort of a reporting, sort of a, interestingly enough, I don't feel like my writing's very sexy or has that sort of feel to it. So no, I guess.
Not sexy, but snarky.
Yeah, I mean,
which works for blogs, definitely a, you go there for a fix of like you know.
I mean, one thing you can choose to do, whatever kind of reporting you're doing, is whether you're going to have opinion or not. There's certain stories that will have my opinion, and then there's some that won't. So no, I don't know. I think I just went on based into sort of like basic reporting and a little bit of creative writing. But nothing real from what you said, no.
Now, you really made your name at the Sword. That's when I first got
San Francisco.
Mm-hmm. And based in San Francisco. Could you tell us about how you transitioned from writing with the magazines and going to the Sword? And then kind of explain what the Sword is. It's such a sprawling thing.
Yeah, so it's a small world, this little adult industry. And so, of course, everyone at the Sword, which is the blog of the porn studio, which is Naked Sword. And so everyone knows each other. And so I knew the people who owned that blog and that company, and they knew they needed to hire someone, and they approached me and they said, do you want to come do the Sword? And I knew...
Now, they had a blog already.
They had the blog. Yeah, okay. The blog had been started by Mike Stabile and Jack Shimama, who both been working in adult in writing and producing for several years. And so they started the Sword in, I think, 2006, maybe 2007. And they asked if I wanted to come take it over. And I knew that things were dying down at Unzipped. And Hear Media owned Unzipped. And they were not very porn-friendly at Hear Media at all. And so I jumped at the opportunity and went over, moved to San Francisco from the LA area. Since I left, you know, they toned down a lot of their editorial. And so now it's more pretty straightforward. It's sort of, they review scenes that are being released. And it's less newsy, less editorial, and more just sort of a collection of reviews of movies and scenes.
And when you got to the Sword, what did they tell you your boundaries were? Did you just do whatever you wanted? What kind of freedom did you have there?
Well, no, there were definitely boundaries, just as there are probably a few boundaries still now. But, you know, they wanted me to be me, I think, and give my opinion on things and cover news as it happened. But, you know, one of the things that's interesting about this porn blogging world is that it is such a small world. So you have to be very delicate with the way that you cover certain things because everyone knows each other. And so if there's certain things that are critical, if you're going to, you know, write something very harsh about someone, somewhere along the line, there's always some sort of business tie. This is a specific example. When I was working at the Sword, I wrote something very, very harsh and very critical of Michael Lucas.
Which is a theme in your career.
Yeah, it's a long-running theme because he's done a lot of really bad things. And so I wrote, I can't remember what it was. I think at that point, it was during an election year, and he had come out and endorsed Mitt Romney, I think. And he came out with this endorsement, and he had been covered by the AP. And so it was an article from the Associated Press. And it says, you know, Michael Lucas, porn producer, supports Mitt Romney. I'm paraphrasing, but it was an endorsement of Romney. And so I wrote about that and made fun of Michael Lucas in some sort of typical way that I would and called him out for that. He then saw the article in the Sword and threatened to pull all of his movies down from Naked Sword's archive, where they have a business relationship. So he threatened to pull all these movies down if we didn't remove what I said about him. And so that was one of the early like examples of like, wow, I can't really say what I want to say here because I had no control over this. And so the article was completely pulled down. And so boundaries, I think, were just, you can't say anything that will cause a business problem for us.
Yeah. Even at the award show a few nights ago, Mr. Pam was like, we don't love everything that you say, but we're glad that you're here to kind of keep us in check. She was very sweet about it.
Right. Yeah. She's interesting because I love Pam and I would call her a leader in the industry in terms of her direction. And she's a hard worker and people want to love and hate and act like they aren't quite sure about things that I write or things that I cover. But, you know, they want to hear good stories and they want to know what's going on. And so,
well, every single industry has its own kind of like inner reporting, you know, Women's Wear Daily, Variety, you know, there's always industrial kind of inside reporting. And if we don't have a blog to do that, then we're
Who's
not going to know
do
what's
it?
Going on.
And they were asking me on the red carpet the other night, like, so you're having this award show and you're really celebrating people and everything's so positive and nice. And does that mean you're going to tone down your edge and change things? And I said, well, absolutely not. I mean, when things happen. You write about things that happen, whether it's good or bad. I mean, this is a straightforward event. There are things that I really, really like, and I write about the things that I like all the time. So this isn't really anything new. It's just a bigger version of the things that are good, I think.
In the news, we're always talking about leaks and sources and all these things. And how do you go about developing context within the industry? How do you know who to trust? And how do you differentiate real information from leaks that are sprung just to hurt other performers or damage the reputation of another studio?
That's a really good question, because sometimes it's really hard. And so everything, I mean, I'm skeptical and I can't publish half the things I hear because there's no way to verify a lot of this information. Because like you said, it's so competitive and people just wanting to bring each other down. I'll get anonymous tips from people, or I'll get fake comments on the site with information. And knowing in the back of my head, like, oh, the person that's telling me this is probably just a director from this studio or an owner of this studio who just wants to say something bad about another studio. If I get information, I verify it the way anyone would verify anything. Whether it's a legal issue, there's usually a document for it or a court case record for it. If it's something that happened on a set, if someone had a bad experience on a set, which happens a lot, models aren't treated fairly on a lot of these sets, whether it's they're not being paid or they're shooting for 14 hours in the middle of nowhere without a break. So you hear these things, and those sort of personal stories that you hear, I tend to usually trust the models because they're employees, for lack of a better
word. They're kind of independent contractors or looking out for themselves.
And so generally, I'll almost always go on the side of the model if they're telling me something that happened on a set. If it's something that happened that I feel like deserves to be put out there in the public eye, then I'll put it out and say, this is what they told me. And then I'll go to the person that they're telling me about and say, they said this. You get the sides of both stories, just like the two sides of any story, I guess. So if it's a personal account of something or an experience, generally I take people for their word. If it's something that's accusing someone of something very criminal or legal, then that becomes a different issue, I think, where you can't write anything, otherwise you
could be liable.
You're defaming someone. So you just have to sort of listen to what they're saying, and there are legal or criminal indications. I always want to listen to what everyone says. So
except maybe Michael Lucas at this point.
That's someone you can't really trust.
Is there like a legion of people within the industry that will come to you even if they know that it might hurt their friend because they know that it's better to report to you? Have you seen like that level of selflessness?
I don't think anyone really has done that, in the sense that I don't think anyone's really told me something that they knew would hurt someone who they genuinely considered a friend. I think there are several people over the years who pretend to be friends with people, but they'll still give the information anyway that they know looks bad. But they probably aren't really friends with that person anyways. So I think the other way to say this is that there's a lot of two-faced characters. Not a lot. I shouldn't say a lot. There are several. But there's a lot of very good people and very genuine people too. So.
If I'm not mistaken, your first post with The Sword was in 2010, and you wrote about performer Brandon Wilde's date with the Minnesota's first openly gay state senator.
That's right.
You know, thankfully, he seemed pretty nonchalant about it, the senator and Brandon Wilde. It kind of sets the tone for how you go on for The Sword and for straight-up gay porn. The post is kind of typical of the political viewpoint that you're not shy about articulating through the gaze of pornography. Can you talk a little bit about your views about the intersection of politics and pornography, and how have your kind of the readers appreciated it or not appreciated it? Because what's great about straight-up gay porn, You have the porn news, and then on the right side, you have, like, the politics news, the general gay news.
Pop culture.
And now, in one website, it's all kind of melded together.
Mm-hmm. I think the thing that's most interesting about that, and why it will always get me riled up and it will get other people interested in reading, is that there's just so much hypocrisy. And everyone who says they don't like porn or they don't watch it or they think certain things should be banned, or, you know, all of these sorts of people, they always have their own secret wishes, their own nasty sort of shady side dealings going on. And so there's always a level of hypocrisy. Like the guy that first story that I wrote for The Sword, that I can't remember his name, but he was a state senator, like you said, in Minnesota. And I think
Paul Coring.
Yeah. So I remember he had voted
against gay marriage in Minnesota. Yeah. Because he said he was in a very conservative district and his constituents didn't want that.
Right. And so here he is, obviously gay, and I think he was openly gay, so that wasn't an issue, but he's hired a prostitute.
On the podcast, we like to call them the sex workers.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm using the legal term just in the sense, because fairly certain it is illegal to hire someone to go on a date with you. And so it was kind of like, well, here's an example of everyone's basically a hypocrite, and they're bigoted hypocrites, a lot of these politicians. And so it's interesting to me because, and the porn industry has always been a target of these people. And so never-ending theme, I guess.
One of the reasons why I wanted to bring it up is because in the Straight Up Gay Porn Awards, which this is why Zach is in town, you opened the ceremony with a powerfully political montage, including news clips, documentary footage, and interviews. The first clip we see is from, I believe, New York City's first gay pride. That's kind of the clip opens up with them. And the voiceover that declares that, quote, pornography brings the essence of gay sexuality into the public arena. We later hear from gay porn historian Jeffrey Escoffier and John Waters talking about the importance of gay pornography to the community. And we also hear a clip that declares that, quote, gay films are the center of gay liberation, and don't you fucking forget that. And it ends with Madonna talking about how erotic it is to see two men making out. Can you tell us a bit about why you wanted to open the show that way, what documentary you used, and you're really setting the tone throughout the whole award show of the political implications of porn.
Yeah, there were so many people who were in that documentary. A lot of the clips were from a movie called Seed Money, which was a documentary on the industry.
It was a powerful way to open the show, because you had also Sean Ford, who won Best Newcomer. He, you know, he brings up a RuPaul quote about every blinking of an eyelash is a political act, and he thinks that doing porn is the same way. It was kind of profound to hear a 21-year-old kind of talk like that, that he feels like he's embodying a political resistance through doing porn.
Yeah, he's got an old soul, I think. He's extremely young, but he's much more articulate than a lot of and a lot of people, so yeah.
Now, kind of going on the theme of the politics of porn, do you think that porn still today is still thought of as really a political act, or is it merely reflecting kind of back our corrupt political nature back to us? Because yes, gay sexuality is still, you know, taboo in some ways, and it is a resistance to the heteronormative culture, but your blog covers all of the hypocrisy, the racism. Is it a progressive forward thing? Is it regressive? Is it both? To you, what are the politics of porn?
I think it's a mix of both. I think there's a lot of people who still work in the business who are from an old school sort of point of view, and they don't think there should be blogs. The older school people who've been doing this for 20, 25, 30 years, they don't think there should be blogs. They don't think there should be comments on blogs. They don't think there should be any news. There should be no news, basically. All there should be reviews of movies and glamour photos and parties and things, and that's it. But at the same time, since the sort of rise of social media and the way that a lot of these performers and directors and everyone else, they live their lives in a very public way now. So they're sharing their lives.
Well, to be a porn performer, they have to be on social media in order to, you know, enhance their brand, because the studios aren't promoting them that way anymore.
Yeah, so there is a little bit of a conflict in that we have to be respectful of who they are and what they're doing, and they have private lives. And you know, just because someone's a sex worker, you have to be careful not to exploit people in ways that it's a really delicate sort of balancing act. A couple of weeks ago, there was a former porn star named Blue Kennedy. And so he was arrested in San Francisco for some pretty graphic, pretty bad charges of dealing with child pornography. A story like that, it came out in SF Gate, I think. And so, you know, when these guys have things that are out being covered in mainstream news, really bad stories, it's like, of course, that's something that I and other bloggers in the industry, they're going to write about it and they're going to cover it. So it doesn't reflect negatively on the industry. I think, well, yeah, sure. I mean, he used to be a porn star, but this is the real world. So it's like, you know, if a corporate banker is arrested for the same thing, then does that reflect negatively on the corporate banking world? I mean, I guess.
Well, in the world of corporate banking, yes.
When anyone from any industry does something bad and they're known as being a certain type of a person, then yeah, it's going to reflect negatively on their industry. But it's the real world. And I mean, yeah, I mean, shit happens. And so that's kind of like the thing that a lot of the older school characters and figures in the industry, they think that everything should be just private. That's not kind of the way things are anymore. I think we cover news just like any other industry would cover news. So if you're a fashion blogger and something happens, somebody in the fashion world has a story, then it's going to get covered just as it would anywhere else.
One of the highlights of the night also was Diesel Washington presenting and calling out the fact that the room was very white. You know, that the industry still has a lot to do when it comes to race. You wrote an article in Vice, Can Social Media Stop the Gay Porn Industry from Hiring Racists? Talking about a porn star, Cameron Diggs, who had white supremacist-style tattoos on his body, and the studios didn't stop his footage from being released until social media kind of called him out on that. The industry still has a lot to do when it comes to race. Do you find that people are actually starting to really think about this more, or is it just like business as usual as you see it within the industry?
It is getting a little bit better, I think, slowly, very slowly.
Well, Dan Savage says it gets better.
Yeah, well, I guess so, if you're taking it in a very slow, methodical sort of a way. And I think it you know, at the root of that, well, there's so many contributing factors to that. And I think, well, A, someone with white supremacist tattoos is a pretty blatant, I don't think people realize that. And they
should have. He has so many, it's hard to find.
Yeah, that he's covered. But, you know, interestingly enough, all the photos he's taking, someone like this is taking shirtless photos, all the tattoos are on full display. And no one really noticed or no one really read into it. But the first photo that shows up on him on a website or on a blog, the first comment that comes out is that tattoo means this. So the first person that sees it notices it. So it is disappointing that the people that, you know, started producing stuff with him didn't realize that. But, you know, now I think people know. We have to look closely at these things. And so it's just a really slow process. And there's so many contributing factors. Well, from blatant racism, people just being racist, whether it's in the production departments at some of these studios, or whether it's in the co-stars who say, I will not work with this person of this race. There are models who say, I will not work with anyone that's black or Asian, Latino, you know, that kind of approach from those guys, I think has been allowed for so long and people have accommodated them. Casting and directing has accommodated that kind of behavior and agents have accommodated that kind of behavior. They're model agents. And it's not just a gay porn world. It's a much bigger deal in the straight world, I think, just from what I have read about that side of the industry.
You know, I think a lot of the excuse will say, oh, well, this is what people want, but... You know,
oh, that too. Yeah, exactly.
But the thing is, we only desire what we see. So if we saw more black and Hispanic people, we would desire them because they're there. Mm-hmm. They would become part of the discourse of what gay pornography means.
Right.
You know, Sean Corey has done some, you know, black performers, but, you know, if they did more, if it was more balanced, then we would know that, you know, people like that kind of stuff too.
Some of these studios say they have 100 models and 98 of them are white and one of them is Latin or Hispanic and then one of them is black. And then they can say, oh no, we do have, you know, two models of color. And
well, watching Helix, you would think that the black people don't exist in San Diego. I've never been to San Diego, but
I don't know.
Maybe there's some black. There might be some black people hiding in the shadows.
I've noticed that they really are trying as well. And so, I mean, again, it's a slow moving process. But in the last year or so, there have been more models of color there than there were before. So I think it's just going to be a slow
See,
process.
I mean, this is what social media is doing. Your article really pointed out. If it wasn't for social media putting the pressure on, it might not be happening at the
Yeah, time. And it's not people like me or people who run other sites or write other blogs. It really is the comments, and a lot of these commenters can be viewed as consumers, obviously. And so if the studio is seen, you know, consumers publicly blasting them, it has an effect. And so I think it's good some of the comments are really bad and really mean, and it makes me want to ban all commenters. But then some of them are really helpful and they can help shape the discussion. So I have a mixed relationship with commenters.
I have to say, though, that I never look at the comment section for other websites, but for straight up gay porn, I look at that comment section and I literally laugh out loud. It's almost like a work of art that they've created with the gifts. Everything. How did this start? Because I don't remember it being as gif heavy on the sword, but then again, gifts weren't as big back then.
Yeah.
Did you cultivate any of this? Like, do you know some of these people?
No, they're very, a lot of them are very funny. I mean, really good. Like you said, with the gifts and the photos, and some of them will write little poems and little vignettes and stories and things. I'm not responsible for any of that. They did that all. And they've, you know, there's a few other blogs that they do that on as well. There's a few of them that you recognize their names and I see them on other blogs sometimes and I'm like, oh, that's so and so. The only thing I don't like about this is that they're all anonymous. So we don't know. I'd say 99% of them are, you don't know who they, I don't know who they are. And so we could be dealing with real people at their houses.
Yeah, you do have people from the industry commenting.
Yes, and some of the people in the industry who comment do use their real names or their real industry names, so we know who they are. I would say there's a lot of people in the industry who are using aliases and commenting.
I was so disappointed. You had a contest where you would match up the baby photo of the porn star with the grown-up porn star, and I got every one of them right except one, and I was so disappointed because you
was
were giving
on the
away...
sword?
Yeah, no, I don't remember, actually.
I think it was on the sword.
Yes, yeah. And you gave away a prize, and I was so upset that I didn't win that. I was so close. New York Gay Pride is tomorrow, so you know, we're kind of in the pride mood right now. I'd like to hear your take on the state of pride these days. It seems to me like pride is kind of at a crossroads, where people are waking up to the conflicted nature of pride parades. that they're sponsored by corporations looking to depoliticize mm-hmm. the gay movement, so there's no distracting people from buying their products. Mm-hmm. There was a controversy in San Francisco Pride a few years ago at the possibility of Chelsea Manning, the mm-hmm. whistleblower, being the grand marshal of the parade. Mm-hmm. It didn't wind up happening, and of course this happened in conjunction with Out Magazine running an editorial saying that she shouldn't be regarded as a gay person to look up to, or mm-hmm. a trans person to look up mm-hmm. to. The progressive politics of Out.
Typical of Out.
Yeah. The Black Lives Matter protesters stopped Toronto's gay pride last year, and this year there was an anti-occupation protest for the Tel Aviv pride for people supporting Palestine. I guess since we're in the pride mood, what mm-hmm. do you kind of make of the state of pride, and do you think that porn has a role to play in this struggle that might not yet be fully realized? Because it strikes me that if we're competing against this corporate idea of what pride is, or what the mm-hmm. pride parade is, does porn have kind of, you know, a way mm-hmm. to get in there and say, well, wait a minute, couldn't we bring this back to sexuality in some way? Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is a little bit of porn in the parades. You'll see models who are on a booth. I think sometimes, you know, cocky boys will have a pride booth, or
right next to Bank of America.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it's just going to get fully corporatized as the years go on. I think then that's just the way everything is. Our culture in general is just completely corporatized. Is that a word?
It is now.
I don't think there's any going back on that. I think we're Wells Fargo and Budweiser and Citibank, you know, we're done. I don't mean to say that like so cynically, but I think we're done in the sense the old school version of Pride that started however many years ago, 40, the first Pride parade 40 something years ago. I don't think we're going to get back to that. And you know what? That's just the way our culture is now, is that everything's become sort of co-opted and bought in one way or another. So I'm pretty cynical when it comes to this kind of stuff. But at the same time, I think Pride is great for if young people can feel and see mainstream things, they can see Bank of America with a float in their parade, then that makes, and that brings someone a sense of like, oh, well, you know, we're normal now, or we're accepted. People feel, I mean, I think the goal of these things is for people to feel accepted and for people to feel welcomed and like proud of who they are. And I think in a weird way, we as a culture identify with a lot of this corporate stuff. And so that helps us to feel where we are or who we are.
I was at a conference recently, and someone made the point that, you know, the pride situation has become so corporatized. And she said, well, we don't have to participate in that version of pride. Pride can be whatever we want it to be. Just because it's not part of the official parade doesn't mean that we can't have our own pride somewhere else. And I think as the pride becomes so much more corporatized, we'll see other versions just springing up that are independent of corporate sponsorship mm-hmm. and things like that. Mm-hmm. So it could be an exciting time.
Yeah, I mean, I think the more protests, the better. So I like when I see Black Lives Matter protesting. You know, I think they did a good thing. I think in LA, we had a pride in LA a couple of weeks ago, and it was, and I don't know if they're doing it elsewhere, but it was like a resist march. And so it was an anti-Trump sort of, there was an anti-Trump theme, which I think is always good. I think the different themes like that are always nice, but we are a corporate world and we're sort of tied into our phones and things like that, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So and I think because it's so much easier for young people to come out in elementary school, so I think there's less stigma on coming out and being gay or being trans. I think it's a lot easier, so in some ways pride isn't as necessary, or it doesn't play the same role that it used to.
Even porn doesn't either. I mean, we're almost the same age, kind of grew up where, you know, there weren't as, mm-hmm. you know, we saw Ellen, we saw, you know, kind of emerging in the late 90s, but we kind of started out in a time where porn was the primary vehicle which we saw gay love, gay community.
That was all I had.
So what do you think about this transition? Like, you and your experience growing up with porn being your idea of gay community versus Ellen, you know, or kind of a Glee, you know, the kind of sanitized version of gay community. Have you thought about that? And then, of course, what role porn plays now? Because since it's maybe not the primary vehicle of gay community and gay love, that now it's something else.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're so used to seeing porn and every celebrity has a sex tape. And so in a lot of ways, a lot of people have become desensitized to it. And so it's like, someone goes on Tumblr and they can scroll down and see 50 million different things for free. And so there's definitely, I think it's less taboo. And so part of the whole appeal of, I think, pornography is the fact that it was taboo and it wasn't allowed. And especially gay pornography was not allowed. And so now that it's more accepted, I guess, and in some ways light, not much, but it's more than it was. And I think now that it's more accepted, there's maybe a little bit of less excitement for it for some of us. That's why a lot of these companies and these studios and directors have had to get a lot more creative with what they're producing. So you've seen much more artistic porn, I guess. So you're seeing, you've seen a lot more storylines. You've seen a lot of more like real filmmaking and cinematography. And
well, what I love about the two studios that won Best Studio, Cocky Boys and Helix, at the award show, was that they really do create a sense of community. Like they use the same porn stars all the time. Uh-huh. They're boyfriends. You can tell they have a real affection for each other, which is quite nice.
Yeah.
I think that's why they're connecting with people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they really have the most interaction with their fans and their fan base. I mean, that's what keeps a lot of these studios going, is how their models interact with their fans. And so if they're all on Twitter and they're all talking day to day with all their fans, like you said, community, it helps keep people waiting to see what they're going to do next, or who's going to be cast with who next.
Or fantasy matchups of who we want to...
Right.
See in the next scene.
Right.
On your Twitter, you pointed out that it gave me some hope for the future that Sean Cody has a higher Alexa web traffic than Out Magazine, which I love. So it shows you that there is still hope for porn in the future. And just, I guess, on an end note, speaking of a work of art, you know, your comment section is a work of art, but also really your Twitter aesthetic, as your Zachary Shire Twitter is very funny, very sharp. Do you have any advice for you how to create a Twitter aesthetic on that level? Like, you really... have perfected this 140 character thing. It's quite fascinating because I'm so terrible at it.
No, I think I'm pretty bad at it, and I don't...
On an objective level, absolutely not. You and Jacob Ladder, I told him at the award show, that he's a genius on Twitter.
He's great. It just depends, right? You know, I have some friends who all I have to do is tweet, hello, good morning, and a selfie, and they'll get 1,000 likes or something. So, I mean...
but they're doing it with their shirts off with a six pack.
Yeah, I mean, some of it's pretty basic. I don't know. I think, well, it goes back to like that sort of the ultimate thing that I learned in writing in school and what I try to do. I try and I don't do it enough, but I think the ultimate style is, or cliche or whatever you want to call it, is that less is more. The stronger point you can make, or the funnier point you can make in the least amount of words, I think is always the most effective for me. I think people like to keep things brief and get in and get out. And so I try to keep things really dry. I try not to get too personal on there, although I do, who knows? I've been such a mess.
Well, we've all fallen in love with your dog, Joey.
So, oh, Joey, yes. That's a bit, yeah. My Twitter is basically just like a collection of dog pics. I'm pretty self-deprecating because that's how I really am in real life. You can't take yourself too seriously on there. People who take themselves seriously there or anywhere, I can't get into that.
Maybe you just discover something. Dog pics are the new cock pics. That could be.
That's a good... I hope you don't mind. I'm going to take that website. Dog pics are the new cock. That's actually really good. I would rather look at dog pics than cock pics.
Yeah, they're so much cuter. So less wrinkles.
Yeah.
Is there anything else that you wanted to say? But the future of gay porn blogging?
Oh, gosh. The future of gay porn blogging. I think the future is going to be in... Oh my gosh, the future will be in, you know, it depends on what these people are producing. So I hopefully, you know, we see more diversity and more high quality content. I'm really thankful for a lot of the stuff that these people, the directors and the studios and what they make and produce and write and shoot. Because if it weren't for them, obviously, I wouldn't be here and 50 other people wouldn't be here. So let's just hope that they continue to... push their content higher, and let's hope they read the comments and they take them to heart. The good comments, not the crazy comments.
Well, thank you so much, Zach. And talking of porn at 9 in the morning isn't the easiest thing, but we could be talking about much worse things. We really did it. Thank you so much for joining us. And
thanks again.
No. Thank you.
Immediately after our interview, Zach headed up to upstate New York for a party being held at the Cocky Boys Mansion. Cocky Boys is the premier gay porn studio operating today, and the three owners of the company have a compound upstate. And all of the main performers were gathering up there for a barbecue to celebrate the award show. I have a feeling like we're going to have to invite Zach back on the show just so we can ask him how the party went. Anyway, be sure to make Straight Up Gay Porn a part of your daily web diet to keep up to date on what's going on in the industry. A link to the entire Straight Up Gay Porn Awards will be included in the show notes, so be sure to check that out. After streaming the show, be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on facebook.com/academicsex and on Twitter @pornocultures. Thanks so much for listening, and I look forward to getting sexy with you next time. Bye.